This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
Hi, I'm Mike Bush.
I'm Paul New.
And I'm Colleen Sterling. Welcome to Ask the AMPs from AOPA.
Now, this is the show where we put the pieces together of your most difficult maintenance puzzles. So if you have a question, email us at podcast@aopa.org and we'll try to get you on the show.
And be sure and subscribe so you never miss an episode.
And if you'd like to be on our email list for our quarterly newsletter and other good stuff, in North America, the easiest way to do that is to text the word SAVVY, S-A-V-V-Y, to 33777. And that will put you on the list. Text S-A-V-V-Y to 33777. And if you're in some other part of the world where that doesn't work, then you can go to the SAVVYAviation.com. Website, and there's a link up at the very top of the homepage.
So I heard some interesting news this week. One of our beloved institutions at my home airport, Gillespie in SoCal, Southern California, is the home to Whirlwind propellers. They make propellers for both airboats and airplanes, and both my husband and I sport a Whirlwind on the front of our Lancers. Mostly experimental, I think all experimental, but a beautiful propeller. And unfortunately, I guess, well, fortunately for Jim Rust, who owns the business, it was bought by Hartzell this recently and is going to come under the Hartzell portfolio for propellers. And they'll be moving the operation eventually out to Ohio, where Hartzell's located. So we're kind of sad to hear that.
Yeah. Hartzell owns everything now.
Yeah, I think this all started when the Brown family decided to sell Hartzell to a venture capital firm who is now like buying everything in sight.
Very scary.
I mean, Hartzell's a great company, but I always get the willies when I see diminished competition in this industry.
Yeah, but they do have the assets, you know, as a big company to keep the product line going. Jim will stay involved with that, and hopefully they will continue to offer it to experimental aircraft. It's a beautiful composite prop. The one that I've got on my Lancer now has just great lines and is a speed boost of at least 5 knots. It's a beautiful upgrade to the aircraft. So
yeah, I remember Colleen, one time when I was down visiting you at Gillespie, we took a tour through the plant.
Oh, did we? Yeah, he has an amazing lathe that it's like the size of a bedroom.
And
I remember when it was delivered.
Those things are absolute works of art. It's just amazing to see them being created in that factory.
The interesting thing about venture capitalists, not always, and I'm not going to down everybody, but the person that started the company, whether it's Plane Power or you know, the prop shop or whatever, there's a passion involved because you don't get into that kind of thing to make money, you know, obviously. And when the big company buys the little company and the person with all that passion is there for a while, but eventually, you know, they're retiring and you start, I get concerned about losing that attitude when it becomes just a business. So I don't know, that's my biggest concern. Some of the innovation, the desire to innovate, let me put it that way, can get lost. I worry about it.
But yeah, it is almost inevitable. You know, somebody starts a business and, you know, if they have kids, they kind of hope that maybe the kids will take over the business.
Right.
If that doesn't work out, then they ultimately need to sell it.
Yeah, there's really, at Whirlwind, there was no middle management. I mean, Jim and his wife, Jim. Patty, they the ran person. The whole place.
And
Colleen, did you say that your information was that they were going to be relocating the Whirlwind facility to Piqua, Ohio, where Hartzell's main?
Yep, so they've invited all their employees to move, and some of them took up the offer because housing's a little cheaper out there than it is in San Diego.
But that's true.
But some of them didn't. I have a really hard time moving from San Diego to Piqua, Ohio. I don't know.
So will it be manufactured along with the other Hartzell propellers, the composite props?
All I know is that they're maintaining it as a separate product line, so that it will still be distinct. But and they're building a different facility for the Whirlwind operation to move into. So, you know, and Jim will remain as a consultant for a while to make sure the transition is smooth. But he wants to have more fun. He says they haven't taken a vacation in years. You know,
I know that like feeling.
30 years. Yeah. Exactly.
So I wonder whether they are going to try to get those propellers certified.
That would be very interesting. They have the power to do that, right?
Yeah, and probably the inside track with the FAA engine and propeller directorate, whoever it is that regulates propeller people.
So I have a question, because we do a lot of prop strikes, and composite propellers are definitely different since you've brought that up. The definition of a prop strike, in part, is if the propeller is damaged enough that you have to pull it off and send it for repair, that qualifies or quantifies it as a prop strike. But composite propellers react very differently to impact. If they hit a tow bar, which is, I mean, it's obvious there'd be a chunk of the propeller that just rips off. But if they hit a traffic cone, which is also like the number two or three thing that composite propellers hit, you'll get this smearing of the orange traffic cone, which putting a traffic cone in the dead center of an airplane is like the worst thing that I can imagine, because the pilot can't see it. You know, if they miss it in the pre-flight, they don't see it. And so I wish FBOs would just not do that. But anyway, so then when someone is determining, is this a prop strike? There's the real probability or possibility of internal damage. So when you look at it and say, well, look, that traffic cone went 100 feet away from the airplane.
And it's not light. Yeah.
It is not light. Yeah, those things weigh some pounds.
They have a base, yeah.
They have a base. And the traffic cone's still in one piece, which is interesting. It did not get sliced in half. In this particular case, this is like the second or third that we've done. but there's no real visible damage to the propeller. And we don't know if there's any inside the propeller, but it was determined, not by me, but by others, that, you know, because we don't know what we don't know, let's look at the inside, let's look at the hub. And so just do an IRAN on the prop just to feel better about it. So in my view, if it goes off and gets an IRAN and everything's fine, then it's not a prop strike. There's a precautionary pulling of the propeller, no damage to the prop, put it back on, fly the airplane away, and you're done. If there is damage on the inside, then that totally changes the view of a prop strike on a composite propeller. It doesn't have the same mass as an aluminum propeller. The reverberations that go back through the engine are going to be different, just because it doesn't flex the same way that a metal prop does. I don't know. And it's in the experimental world with a Whirlwind prop, do you have prop strikes? And
so my airplane had a strike against with the previous prop, with the previous owner, against a tow bar. And
was
they
it
took
a metal
the prop. No, it was a
Whirlwind. Oh,
it was an Aero Composites. It was an Aero Composites composite prop. And they took the prop over to Jim Rust at Whirlwind, and Jim looked at it and did an inspection and said it was fine, and basically just dressed it out and cleaned it up, and they put it back on. So in that case, against a metal tow bar, and I've been operating that prop and racing it, and it's been fine. So,
yeah, I would find it really hard to imagine that a composite prop would suffer damage hitting a traffic cone.
Yeah, I don't know. So the two...
That's composite. Just do a tap test on it. That's just like any other piece of composite, right?
I mean, props are subject to a lot of force. And so that prop picked up a traffic cone and threw it that far away pretty quickly. But I think that props are built to take that kind of a force.
Yeah, so, how about this? Fly it 100 hours. If it doesn't come apart, it's okay.
Well...
You so dodged a bullet. Kind of like a cam that hasn't been in service for a while.
Hasn't been
100 hours. If it isn't making metal, it's okay.
I mean, also the composite prop flexes more than I think the metal prop. So maybe it's able to absorb some of that impact too.
Well, we had it was not our customer. It became our customer for the short duration, a local guy. And he hits a traffic cone. This is like our first experience with a traffic cone impact. And it happened to be on one of the Moonies with the big engine, one of the newer ones. So he takes off at night after this. He knew he hit the traffic cone, takes off at night, comments about his takeoff roll was about 3 times normal. And in cruise, he could only do about 120 knots.
Oh, yeah. We've heard this story before.
Yeah. And one blade, his mechanic goes out to look at the plane, and two blades look normal. And the third blade rotates 360 degrees in the hub.
Oh, my gosh.
The pitch change link broke.
Yeah. And it still had the traffic cone embedded in it, right? Just kidding. Oh, I didn't catch that. It was dark.
Yeah.
Wow. So,
just in case any listeners are thinking traffic cones are a benign strike, they might be, but they might not be.
Do a careful inspection.
So, yeah. If you hit one, at least shut the engine down and get out and go have a look. So our first question is from Mike, who's leaning toward the good side.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Colleen and Mike. Thank you, guys. I've been listening to the podcast for a long time now, and I've really, really enjoyed it. So thanks for having me on the show. So I fly a 2017 Turbo 206 and then occasionally a 1981 421. Nice. And I'm trying to become a child of the Church of Lean here. And we went through and got the GAMI injectors on the 206, and we did all the GAMI tests. We've uploaded everything into Savvy and looked at it, and the numbers got a lot tighter between the cylinders. And they're probably not perfect. We could probably do another round of GAMI tests and have them reconfigured, but they're pretty good.
What are they down to?
I'd have to look. They're 50-ish, maybe a little bit more, but they're pretty close.
On
the
upper,
or not, sorry, 50s, but then the EG, the fuel flow is within like half a gallon, I think.
Half a gallon. Okay.
Perfect. That's good.
Yeah. Yep. You're good.
So on the 206, when we normally I fly it like 28 inches, 2300 RPM, and it's like 67% power. And then we were always told when we were getting trained on the plane, like, hey, just fly at Richard Peak. It's, fuel's cheaper than metal. Type thing, right? So,
which is why we fly lean a peak.
I don't know if it is anymore, but it used to be. So, and we've run at 50 to 100 Richard Peak, and it's fine. Every time I've gone lean a peak, it's just I understand it's going to be less power and it's going to run slower, but I don't know if it's maybe there's such a small rumble window for functionality in there, and I haven't found it yet, or it's just the roughness doesn't feel right. It just feels gutless. At one point, I was flying over the, and I was like, it was like surging almost. It felt like the engine was surging. Like, I don't know. It's kind of weird. I just hadn't get it right. So I was wondering if there's any tips and tricks or if anything's different running lean a peak on turbo charged engines.
Well, start with being sure the magneto timing is set really close. Like with a digital protractor. Well, on a Lycoming, you don't have to have a digital protractor because if they're using good tools, it's marked on the back of the flywheel.
Yeah.
You can also do it on the front of the flywheel using a indicator that's built into the starter. But I've seen very few people be able to do that reliably because they can't handle the parallax error. But if you get the timing set really close, like within a 0.1 or 0.2 degrees per magneto, that will help and get your spark plugs gapped tight. So they're your 16 to 18 thousandths, gap them at 16. That will help quite a bit.
Because you get a good fat spark at the right time.
That makes sense. And so kind of a follow-up question on that is, you know, you guys always preach about managing CHTs, and I think that we do a really good job of that. You know, 380 is always our number. I think one time over the history of the plane, we got up to 395 on one cylinder, and that's it. Like,
wow.
But when we talk about, like, when you guys talk about how as you lean the engine out and you get to, like, peak cylinder pressure and then you start coming back down, you know, if we're close to peak cylinder pressure, possibly with either on the rich or lean side, but then we control the CHTs a little bit with the cowl flaps. How does that, like, how does managing the cowl flaps affect where you're at with CHTs and all that stuff? Or am I overthinking this whole situation here?
You're kind of overthinking a little bit. First of all, light combings cylinders, we don't get too excited unless the CHT gets above about 420.
Yeah.
So trying to keep the CHT at 380 on light combing is being a little overprotective. And we'll probably, if that's what you're trying to do, it's likely that you may be running leaner of peak than the engine is happy with. So the engine's always going to run slightly less smooth lean of peak, because that's just kind of the nature of lean of peak. There's more cycle to cycle variation, but it shouldn't be running uncomfortably rough. And if it is uncomfortably rough and you've got a decent gammy spread, which it sounds like you do, then it sounds like you're probably leaning it a little bit further than it's happy.
Okay. Yeah. I thought I was about 50, but I think it sounds like we just need to play with it more, maybe, and get more comfortable and check the timing and the magnetos, the spark plug. So
just give it a little, richen it a little bit and see if it smooths out.
Try to find a fuel flow that gives you around 400 degrees CHT is just perfect. 410 would be okay. Try not to let it go over about 420.
Okay, so on the lean side, you know, brooding around 400 is okay then. Okay, good.
Yeah, light combing cylinders typically run about 20 degrees hotter than continental cylinders for some good engineering reasons, and they're built to take a quite a bit higher CHTs. They have a more robust head to barrel junction. But
if he's lean of peak, Mike, he should be much lower than 400. Yeah. I mean, even close to peak, if he's on the lean side, I mean, he should be lower than that. He shouldn't be at 400. Don't you think? He shouldn't even have to use cowl flaps.
The only thing about the 206 is you've got a lot of power and a lot of drag.
Okay.
So you don't get a lot of cooling air over the engine, even in cruise.
Okay.
It's doing 130 knots on a good day. Well, unless you're at 18,000 feet.
And that's a very effective cowl flaps.
They're massive.
They're huge.
You have huge air inlets on the front of the cowling.
They're big shovels.
Yeah, exactly. So one thing also, once you figure out where your power is going to be, forget all the EGT stuff and just lean to the fuel flow. Since you're turbocharged and you set up a specific RPM and manifold pressure and you go to a fuel flow that you predetermined is 30 degrees lean of peak, just to pick a number, no matter your altitude, that same RPM and manifold pressure and fuel flow is going to give you the same result. So whether you're cruising at 6,000 feet or 17,000 feet, you can use the same power settings and same leaning every time. So you do the quick, big pull. Works out really well.
So yeah. I was thinking that I had to be at like 50 degrees lean at peak, but if I got closer to peak, that's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Sure. As long as the CHTs are reasonable.
Yep.
Yeah. And once you find that, then just go to that same fuel flow and it'll be the same place.
It's easy with the turbocharger. Yeah. Nice.
What is their red line manifold pressure on that engine? About 36 or something?
39.
Oh, 39. Okay.
So one last question, if you guys don't mind, because you kind of mentioned the flight levels for a minute there. when I was doing some of my initial SIM training with a big SIM company on the 421, they mentioned, we were talking about Lena Peak, and the guy went through this, the whole Cirrus red box thing and all that kind of stuff. But he also said, if you're flying in the flight levels, don't even bother going Lena Peak. You ever heard that and what that's about?
That's silly.
Did he have a reason for it?
You know what? I didn't ask him because I was just yeah. I was just being like inundated with so much information that week that I didn't think about asking him. I figured with the turbocharged engine, whether you're at 200 feet or flight level, you know, 20, it shouldn't
matter. I could think of a reason why they may give, and that may be that the engine gets too cold at that altitude. When you're lean of peak, it's maybe it reduces the power.
I've fly my T310R lean of peak at flight level 200.
I've seen it.
I'll often, you know, I probably won't be able to keep the RPM as low as 2300 up at that altitude, because I'll probably go into bootstrapping. Have to increase the RPM a little bit.
You know, that may be what they were talking about, because you get into bootstrapping on that. On that Gitzio engine, maybe they were just being cautious that you don't start.
But, you know, the typical way to deal with bootstrapping is to increase the RPM a little bit.
Can you explain what bootstrapping is?
Yeah, it's when the turbo system no longer can regulate. You're up high enough where the wastegate has gone all the way closed, and it can't close any further, and so the manifold pressure will go unstable on you.
Okay.
And normally the way you deal with that, if you notice it, is you increase RPM a little bit to the point where it's back in the regulating range.
Okay.
Your RPM and fuel flow and all that will just start, you'll be chasing it, trying to adjust engine controls to, you know, the manifold pressure goes up, then it goes down. That's the usually what you see.
Okay. I think that might have been what happened with me with the 206 when I talked about it surging on that trip, because I was probably around, like, I think it was 15,000 feet or something like that, heading out to Utah. And that was kind of doing that weird thing. So, and it was colder out, so maybe that was happening at that point.
No, and again, if you're running excessively lean a peak, then you're going to bootstrap at a lower altitude.
Okay, that's probably what I did in the 206 then. Okay, good to know.
Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Well, you guys have been very helpful. Thank you for the information. So.
Yeah. Glad to help. Good question.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Thanks, and Mike. We'll see you around town. I'm up in San Luis Obispo.
Oh,
Oh, well.
Neighbors.
Yeah. Thanks for all your guys' help, and I appreciate the podcast. Great work here.
Yeah. Sure. Enjoy those
planes. Take care, Mike.
Will do. Take care. Thank you.
See you, Mike.
Our next question is from Adam, who doesn't want to adopt an orphan. Go ahead, Adam. Explain that.
Right. In fact, I never even would have thought of this if I hadn't read the August 23 Rudder and Wrench article in AOPA, highlighting the fact that if a company goes out of business, there's some question as to who will make decisions on the AD equivalents for light sport aircraft. I'm on a budget. I have two kids in college, and so I tend to look towards whatever the cheapest option is. I'm the guy renting the Cessna 150D at John C. Toon. And I can't get any cheaper until my kids get out. But the designs I've looked at are interesting designs, but it does make me worry. I mean, even Mooney has gone out of business a number of times. And so with a light sport aircraft, what happens if the FAA doesn't want to take that over?
Well, the good news is, first of all, the bad news is that the FAA would not want to have anything to do with it. The FAA has been very clear that they don't want to get involved in light sport aircraft. The good news is, if the manufacturer goes out of business, then the manufacturer isn't going to be issuing any new safety directives, because there isn't any manufacturer to issue them. So it would almost be like, for certificated aircraft, if the FAA decided to go out of business, and then we wouldn't have any more ADs. That sounds like a great idea. Let's run that up the pole.
but you'd be out of luck with product support, because you'd have no source for spare parts.
But that's true. Whether it's
an LSA or a
certificated aircraft, if the manufacturer goes out of business,
you'd hope that somebody would do aftermarket parts.
It'd probably be some some owner association that would band together and do what needs to be done, which is typically what happens when.
Do you think they would allow that? Who's the they?
I think he means the FAA.
The FAA.
Yeah. FAA doesn't want to have anything to do with this.
Yeah. I mean, the FAA lets you do owner-provided parts. That's kind of a big clause.
I mean, but the thing about LSAs is they don't have a type certificate. They're not approved by the FAA. It's the FAA has basically opted out of the LSA business. They've said they're built to consensus standards, not FAA standards. And the FAA isn't going to question the consensus standards, although I think the FAA actually has representatives on the ASTM, not ASTM, but on the committee that develops the consensus standards. But the FAA doesn't control them. The FAA doesn't certify them. The FAA doesn't issue ADs for them, and so on. Now, it is possible that there may be some changes in this area with this new Mosaic rule that is in the pipeline and going through comments and so on, because I think there's a very good case to be made that the current LSA rule that basically says you have to do what the manufacturer says is illegal, is a violation of the Administrative Procedures Act. And I think the FAA may wind up having to walk that back. So the answer to these questions may change after the Mosaic rule is the final rule is adopted.
Yes, sir. On the other side of the spectrum, with established companies like Piper, with their Piper Sport 2010-2011 and Cessna's 162 Skycatcher, could they turn around and say, we've decided your airframe turns into a pumpkin at 30 years or 3,000 hours, whichever comes first?
Well, they haven't done that yet, and there's an awful lot of airplanes.
They can't do that.
Yeah.
That what they can't, you know, Paul, you and I have been through this. What they could do is to say any new production Skycatchers have a life limit of so on, but except we all know there aren't going to be any new production Skycatchers because Cessna decided to walk away from this program. But the basic rule is that manufacturers can't change the rules in the middle of the game for an aircraft owner. If you bought an aircraft that was built in, you know, 1999 or something like that, the rules that were in effect for that aircraft when you bought them, but when it was manufactured, are the ones that continue to be in effect. And the only way that can be changed is by airworthiness directive from the FAA. The FAA theoretically could issue an AD life-limiting the aircraft, but the manufacturer can't do that. The only thing the manufacturer can do is do something for aircraft going forward, not going backward. The only way a manufacturer could life limit an aircraft is to get the FAA to sign off on an airworthiness limitation. Because even the manufacturer doesn't have the authority to life limit anything. The life limits have to be either an airworthiness limitation, which is something the FAA signs, or an airworthiness directive.
But since there's no ADs for live sport,
then nobody's going to limit anything. There's nobody to do the limiting.
But again, it is conceivable that after this Mosaic thing all shakes out, it could possibly be that the FAA decides to take responsibility for airworthiness directives for those airplanes. But as things presently stand, there is no such thing as an airworthiness directive against a light sport aircraft.
So go ahead and adopt that orphan.
Well, yeah, the other limiting factor is my wife and I are about a 350-pound team, and I hope Mosaic allows the takeoff weight to creep up a little bit. But thank you for considering my question.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, it's a good question, Adam.
Interesting question. I learned something. It's funny, you always think about ADs as being onerous to owners, but the way Mike puts it, it's almost like ADs are kind of protecting us from the manufacturers doing crazy things. It's a process that they have to go through and convince the FAA that it's worth imposing a life limit. So it works both ways.
Yeah, airworthiness limitations. When I talk to people in classes about it, the word airworthiness is kind of a special word that only the FAA gets to use. And so if you see airworthiness something, the FAA probably had their hands in it. So an airworthiness limitation, even though it's published in the service manual for an airplane, it wasn't created by the manufacturer. In other words, they're not the one that's forcing you to do it. The FAA is doing it. They're just doing it in the form of Chapter 4 of the service manual.
Right. And the word airworthiness only applies to things that have type certificates. So you can't say that an RV4 is airworthy. You can only say that an RV4 is in condition for safe operation. And I think the same thing is also true of LSAs, that because they don't have type certificates, the word airworthiness doesn't really apply to them.
So there's no equivalent from the manufacturer.
Equivalent to what?
To an airworthiness or to an AD?
Yeah, the equivalent for LSAs is what's called a safety directive, which is effectively like an AD issued by the manufacturer, which shouldn't be allowed, but presently is.
So the nightmare scenario is the manufacturer decides to limit the life by their equivalent of an AD.
But they can't do it after the fact. In other words, the airplane has already been built and sold. The manufacturer, I guess they might be able to do
well,
that.
Well, I'm not so sure when it comes to LSAs, because the rules that we're used to don't really apply to LSAs.
Right.
And the rules that presently applies to LSAs probably are illegal.
Well, so if they come out with a life-limiting safety bulletin like that, it will be challenged in court and we'll find out. Mm.
It hasn't happened to date by any of the manufacturers that we know of.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a question of whether an LSA manufacturer could issue something like that. It's a question of whether you'd have to pay any attention to it. I mean, right now there's this crazy debate about when Rotax requires that an engine be overhauled at 12 years regardless of hours. If it's a Rotax on a certificated aircraft, and there actually are certificated Rotax engines, then everybody knows you don't have to pay any attention to that. Nobody cares what Rotax says. You know, you can run the engine as long as you want. For LSAs, it's really an open question, because the LSA rule basically says you have to do whatever the manufacturer says you have to do, which I think would not stand up in court if it was challenged. But that's the way the regulation reads. That's why I think that there's a fair chance that that may get changed, because I don't think it would stand up to a court challenge. But a couple of people asked the FAA to give a legal interpretation of whether TBOs on an LSA are compulsory or not. And the FAA, Office of Chief Counsel, issued two different opinions by two different FAA lawyers spaced a year apart that said diametrically opposite things. One said, yeah, they're compulsory. The other one said, no, they're not.
So pick your favorite ruling.
Yeah. So then I wrote a very long letter to the Office of Chief Counsel some years ago saying, hey, this is really embarrassing, folks. You know, you really need to pick one or the other. And I suggest you pick the one that says that TBOs aren't compulsory, because it just doesn't make sense for the FAA to hold light sport aircraft to a more restrictive requirement than they do for certificated aircraft. It contradicts, you know, longstanding FAA policy that smaller airplanes are held to less restrictive standards, smaller airplanes and slower airplanes. And the FAA chewed on my letter for about 2 years. And then I got a call from the lawyer who had been assigned it saying, Mike, I'm sorry to tell you this, but we're not going to respond to your letter. It's a hot potato. And nobody wants to touch it. We've been talking to the airworthiness division, and they don't want to have anything to do with it. And we're just going to have to ignore it. So that's where it stands. That's where I'm kind of hoping that Mosaic maybe straightens it out.
So stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned, Adam.
Will do.
Okay,
well, thanks, Adam.
Good luck with your search, Adam, and yeah, I'm sure you'll find something fun to play with. Yeah.
All right.
Thanks for calling.
So our next question is from Garrett, who's having some bad luck with his maintenance shops. What's up, Garrett?
Hey, guys. Yeah, so I've been fine for about 10 years now. Had several incidents. I put them in the email there. I think I was a little worked up that day, so I was going to keep it a little more, just keep it to the advice here. So currently I'm just trying to be around anytime there's maintenance performed. I learn what I can, do what I can, and put my own skin in the game. You know, I'm there and I'm part of the process.
Great.
I've looked into a few ways of getting my EMP. I know I can log the time working on my own airplane, either preventive maintenance or under supervision. I've looked at building an experimental, you know, something easy maybe. And I've looked at...
That doesn't exist.
Yeah. Good luck.
Okay.
Just scratch that one off.
Okay. Scratch. Done. And I've looked at getting my light sport repairman certificate just as some sort of, you know, formal training. Are there any other avenues I haven't considered? And what do you think of... well, now I know what you think of one of those, but what do you think of the other two?
Well, you could go to school. If you had the time, you could go to school. I mean, there's schools around the country that have night programs if you're working during the day, or day programs if you're unemployed or working during the night. But, I mean, that's the standard way to do it. It's not easy. It takes time, but it's also a fun journey. That's the way I did it. So
this is typically like a 2-year program.
Yeah.
We have a couple in the area, but we got 4 boys, and they're not, they're not nearby. So yeah, it'd be a time thing. Yeah, I'd love to go otherwise, but pretty much not an option. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an interesting question. You get time if you're hands-on supervised. That doesn't mean they're standing there watching you, but you can purchase the general study guide, the airframe study guide, the power plant study guide. Would the FAA count time spent studying those? I guess not. That sure
I don't
would
think
count.
So.
I mean, just, I can tell you, just reading through those 3 study guides, you will learn a huge amount of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the
material's
great.
And the new ones have great illustrations,
or the textbook.
Too.
Read the textbook. It's a great book. They've redone it. But I think it's experience. You have to have experience.
You have to have experience. But to me, reading the manual, because my guys, step one to any job is open the manual. Read the process in the manual.
Right. And they're on the clock when they do that, probably.
They're on the clock when they do that.
Yeah,
so
they should be. Right. Yeah.
It should count as experience.
I think that's... So if you take your manual to the shop, where the mechanic is, and you're studying the manual, I think you got to count that time.
All right. Oh, all right. That's part of the process.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
if you're
the
in the shop. Yeah.
You're
if
in the shop. That's got to be part of it.
But ask Mike. I mean, gaining experience by, you know, that's a long road.
It
How
is.
Much, it is a very long road. Yeah. It basically took me 10 years to amass the, because it's 4,800 hours of experience if you do it apprenticeship basis.
They don't make it easy on purpose.
Months.
They don't want, you know, Yahoo's getting their AMP.
You're
ready.
It's incredibly unfortunate that the FAA does not offer anything along the lines of a limited repairman certificate to the owner of a certificated airplane that wants to work on his own airplane. It would really be a good... And, you know, one of the frustrating things about studying for the A&P is because the mechanic certificate in the U.S. basically lets you swing wrenches on anything from a Piper Cub to a 747, the A&P test requires that you study all sorts of stuff you know you're never, ever going to use. Air cycle machines.
Cabin atmosphere.
You know, all kinds of turbine engines.
Yeah.
You know,
helicopter
roots blowers.
Helicopters, yeah. And, roots just, blower, yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
Stuff that you just know has no relevance. So you're going to forget, you know, class. 5 minutes mm-hmm. after you take the test, you're going to forget it.
Sure.
You know, and what wood and fabric stuff that you probably aren't going to use if you're, you know, if you own a Cherokee, it's really a too all-encompassing certificate, and there's nothing, you know, in between, which there really ought to be. But
here's what I would suggest, because I understand your situation, and it's not uncommon. We have a lot of owners that choose to come here and do, we call it an owner assist annual, but there's really no such thing. Nobody can assist in the annual inspection. What you can do is assist in opening and closing and all that. So to be real clear, only the IA can do the inspection, but you can do all the other stuff. But what I would suggest is, and I've sort of alluded to this before, the more I thought about it, the more I liked it. Isn't that great? If you have an idea, you think about it more, you like your idea more.
Sounds insidious.
Yeah, it does. It's like this closed loop.
So what is this idea, Paul?
The idea is that when you're doing maintenance or someone is doing maintenance on the airplane, you be sure that the service manual comes out, find the process for that repair, and make sure, so you now become the supervisor, or more accurately, the manager of your maintenance, which is what you really should be. And you make sure that whoever is actually doing the hands-on, whether it's you and or a certificated mechanic, are following the process that's in the manual. Most things that you're going to do are written somewhere. Now, it's not approved procedures, it's accepted procedures. So if you don't find it in the 172 service manual, which, by the way, you want to have a copy of, you can go to Advisory Circular 4313-1B, and it'll have everything that your service manual doesn't have. And for every single procedure that you're doing on the airplane, see if you can find it written somewhere, and be sure the shop follows that. I saw something in what you wrote as we're listening to you here about the airplane was rigged wrong. The procedure is in the manual. And if they're doing it without looking at the manual, they're just out making stuff up. And so you get to be the person that stops them from making stuff up. And you can be the QA person at the same time. And you can record all this time as your experience, because that's what you're doing. It's all about the maintenance. And your AD research is part of the experience as well. You're going to have your AMP by next year, I'm telling you.
That's a lot of work.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the maintenance man.
I think you can definitely log the time that you spent on this podcast. That's absolutely creditable.
Perfect. That's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. Hook you up. We'll get him on again.
A repeat offender.
Yeah, great. It sounds like stick with working on mine. That's mostly what I'm concerned about, right? Is I'm trying to take care of my airplane. Mm-hmm. And not just because I don't trust somebody, but so that I know what I'm looking at, and I instruct as well. So
do you have friends that have airplanes that work on their airplanes?
Yeah.
You can go help them. Now, you can't sign off the work you do on someone else's airplane, but you can certainly
it counts as experience.
Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah. Good point.
Just log it though. Keep track of it.
Keep track of it.
Yeah. I already reached out to the FISDO and just clarified, you know, what I need to log, and they're pretty relaxed about it. And they said just, you know, good records and mm-hmm. get a signature once in a while, basically. Yep. And
in number, date, description of what you did.
Yeah. So it does sound like you guys recommend reading the books, the handbooks.
Oh yeah. You're going to have to study them to take the test eventually anyway.
Get cozy with them. Yep.
Yeah, get cozy with them. There's good information in there. A little bit of bad information.
Yeah, that's one of the frustrating things about taking the A&P knowledge test is you have to memorize all the FAA wrong answers in order to get a good score.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yep, that's true.
All righty.
Okay.
Good question.
Yeah. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, we like hearing people.
When you get your
AMP,
call me up. I got a job for you.
Yeah, yeah. Paul's got a job. I think he wants to go to the airlines, probably.
Yeah. All righty. Well, yeah, okay. Thanks, guys. Appreciate
have
it.
Fun with
thanks,
that.
Garrett.
Thank you.
Okay, a couple of letters this time, and I'm interested to get your feedback here. First one's from Robert. He's talking about the technique where you run the engine hard to maybe see the rings a little bit better and lower oil consumption. He said this was in the Slobberpot episode. And he said, I have some questions about performing this remedy. Is it really balls to the wall? I can understand full throttle, but is the RPM to be pulled back slightly? What sort of leaning, if any, do you recommend? And I heard a time period ranging from 15 minutes to the entire flight from Colorado to Kansas. Any way you can offer more discussion to help me decide what time period would be appropriate to me to try this?
Well, you want high manifold pressure. I don't know that the RPM
want maximum
is that important.
Manifold pressure, pulling back the RPM would probably be helpful. And I would want to try to fly it that way for an hour or two.
Yeah. Or several
and
flights.
See, and then see how it, you know, see what the, if it's helped.
Yeah.
You'd want to watch your CHDs? I mean,
sure.
Yeah.
I mean, all the normal, you're going to be running at a high power setting. So, you, depending on the altitude, if you're in Colorado, you're not going to be able to get as good a test. But if you're close to sea level, if you can fly it at 1,000 or 2,000 feet, you're probably going to be rich of peak. And if your CHDs are managed, you can fly it like this for hours. And hours and hours.
I've got a somewhat related question for Paul. I'm just wondering if because you've been around long enough, you might even have been exposed to this. But you know, the question comes up periodically that you know, an engine isn't broken incorrectly, and the cylinders get glazed, and the oil consumption never really stabilizes. And you know, the question is there any less invasive procedure for dealing with a glazed cylinder other than the conventional pull it off and rehone it? And it occurred to me that Lycoming had some procedure like for decarbonizing cylinders that involved putting walnut shells inside the cylinder and blowing them around and then...
Oh, walnut shells.
Yeah.
That'll do it.
I've never seen anybody actually do that.
There was a service bulletin about that.
You get
walnut
shells everywhere.
I was wondering whether some sort of a walnut shell blast could cure a glazed cylinder so that you could then go ahead and try to break it in properly.
I've never tried it. I can't imagine how you're going to get the walnut shells to be abrasive enough. I mean, you think about the rings sliding up and down under pressure in operation. At the temperatures and all that kind of stuff, that's about as abrasive as you can get. And I would just have a hard time imagining the walnut shells being successful. Although,
glazing is not dirt, though. Glazing isn't it a too
it's like
smooth
a varnish.
A surface?
It's a varnish, yeah.
Oh, is it? But I still don't think walnut shells would take that off.
I don't think so. And it basically it kind of fills up all the honing so the oil can't find the channels to work its way where it needs to go.
Exactly.
I can't imagine that walnut shells work. Having said that, I've never tried it. So maybe someone out there that's actually tried it and can directly relate that to the change.
I guess the other question is whether there would be some procedure similar to our ring flush procedure where you would like fill a combustion chamber with some nasty
chemical
aggressive solvent, let it sit overnight, you know, soften its... this glaze somehow, I don't know.
If we came up with a chemical that would take care of the glaze and the oil control ring groove,
at the same time,
it would probably melt the sump when it drained back into the oil pan.
It'll probably melt all the walnut
the
shells
made
from
of
the
metal.
First time.
I don't think it's going to melt the sump.
I don't know. I'm thinking the stuff that's in that piston ring groove is so hard. I don't know what you would use to dissolve that. I mean, you throw a piston in a...
Oh, the piston ring groove?
The piston ring groove.
Oh, we're not talking about glazing now.
No, okay. But I think it's going to... You're going to have the same kind
of chemical.
Yeah,
the piston ring groove, you're not... You can't really dissolve that stuff.
Right.
You have to mechanically force it out.
Chip it out.
That's what we're doing with the
putty knife.
The flush.
But I think whatever you're going to use to get the glaze off the cylinder walls,
I think I talked to Ed Collin, and he said the only thing he knows of that could dissolve that stuff is boiling water, which I don't think is practical for the ring flush procedure.
Well, so the glazing on the cylinder wall, I sort of equate it. This is probably totally wrong, but it fits in my head. So just wait for it.
It's like paint thinner would.
Well, it's like a cast iron skillet. When you season it.
Yeah.
Season a cast iron skillet. How do you get that stuff off? Get that sucker really hot and pour water in it. But you still don't get rid of the glazing. You just get rid of all the other stuff. That's how you clean them. The only way to get that stuff off a cast iron skillet is a scouring pad.
Scour it off, yeah.
And maybe a Ziz wheel with Scotch.
Your walnut shells wouldn't do it, huh?
I don't know. I don't think you could get the walnut shells up to a critical velocity in that short a distance.
And
to clean the cylinder walls.
That's a lot of walnuts to crack. Sorry.
It's a lot of walnuts. Sorry,
I think you can buy walnut shells.
Our next question is from Victoria, who is ready to break out the power tools to keep your airplane clean. Go ahead, Victoria.
Okay. Well, my husband and I are based out of KMJX in New Jersey Pinelands, and we're not allowed to use water due to runoff. We're trying to keep our 2022 SR22 turbo clean, and without being able to use water, we're trying to just, you know, wipe it down each time. But any suggestions for, you know, chemicals, what we should use, what we shouldn't be using? Presently now, using the, you know, plexiglass on the windshield, aviation simple green on the leading edges. We were doing a pretty good job keeping up with it until we went to a friend's fly-in where we got parked on a dirt path. And when we left there, it was covered, in dirt. So up until that time, we were doing pretty well with wiping it down every time we were using it. Any suggestions for what we can be using to keep it clean and shiny? Because I like to detail. I like things to be nice and shiny.
Me too.
I have two suggestions. One is to use water in the middle of the night when nobody's looking.
Just a bucket of water. Who's
and then
catch
the other
it?
Is if you absolutely, I don't know, if you are sufficient tree hugger that you really don't believe in doing that, then fly the airplane somewhere where you're allowed to use water.
We have been talking to some friends at other locations.
And then don't hit any bugs on the way back.
Well, I don't mind doing it, you know, each time we stop, and we land. That's my job, okay. Literally, as my husband's pushing the plane back into the hangar, literally, I'm standing on the, on the wing doing the windshield, as he's pushing it in. Okay. My Christmas present was, the creeper to go underneath the plane.
Are you saying that this Looney Tune airport that you're based at considers water a hazmat, or what exactly is the?
Because of the runoff. We're in the Pinelands in New Jersey. Okay.
So you can't hose it. You can't hose it down, but could you just have a bucket of water?
The pines like or water? Is the...
Come on. Yeah.
That's all the oils and greases.
Yeah, we have just been informed that we are not allowed to wash our airplane, at our site. Okay.
Yeah.
From what I understand, my husband says that they do have, if you want to pay for it, they have...
A detailer.
Okay.
I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't let anybody touch my airplane. I would clean my airplane myself with water out of a water bottle, just wetting a rag. And then for my Lance Air, which is a plastic airplane like yours, carbon fiber or fiberglass, I just use a cleaner wax after I bring it back in and just wipe the bugs off. But if it needs a deep clean, like you're talking about, I would use a bucket or just a wet rag and wipe it down in the hangar where they can't see you because it's your private space.
And it'll evaporate before it runs off.
If you're using Simple Green or something, aren't you supposed to wash that off with water after you use it?
I just wipe it off. I just spray and wipe off.
We have not been, so is that something we should do? Because is that going to be then dulling the shine if we're not washing off the Simple Green?
No. But it does take the wax off, so you got to wax it after.
So there's the two different kinds of cleaning. Talk about deep clean, like handprints, greasy handprints, that
oil.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oil, that sort of thing, like on the belly. We use a product called Crazy Clean, and we buy it in aerosol cans, and it's not an
aviation
product.
Spelled with a K, right?
Spelled with a K.
Really?
And it's awesome stuff. Wait, is it spelled with a K? Now that I think about it, it may not be. Anyway, Crazy Clean, you can buy it all sorts of places. And it is phenomenal. It actually phenomenal. But you probably don't want to use it on the whole airplane. Like, spring's coming up, pollen. All the airplanes in Jackson, Tennessee will be at this greenish yellow color pretty soon.
Is this Crazy Clean stuff a liquid that you spray
on?
Yeah,
it's a liquid. You spray it on and you just wipe it off. It's phenomenal for handprints and bugs. Do not use it on the plexiglass windows and windshield.
How about aluminum? Is it?
Yeah, it works great on aluminum. Oh, really? We use it on everything in the shop.
Okay.
And I don't own stock in the company or anything. It's just something that we use that works. But for the pollen and all that, there's a, and we don't use it here because we're allowed to use water. But there's, you know, the dry clean. Have you seen that? You spray this stuff on with a rag. It's a, well, now I, you know, drawing a blank. I can't tell you the name, but there's a dry clean. Cars use it, airplanes use it. And you just get a soft cloth. Be careful. The cloth is scratching your paint and your windshield.
Oh, no. So we have specific cloths, just soft cloths. It's only for the plane. Doesn't go in with any of the other wash. No detergents. Okay.
Yeah.
So we have our own bucket of, you know, wipes.
Take the labels off of them.
It's still doing, there's no way to not do damage. The best way, if you want to clean the windshield, microfiber is good. But the best way to clean the windshield is with like Dawn dishwashing liquid and water and your hand.
Your hand?
Oh. Your hand, absolutely. And that's actually what Cessna calls out for cleaning windshields in their service manual. Be sure and take your wedding ring off.
Do you have to rinse it afterwards?
Well, yeah. So you're going to get you spray the Dawn with water, with a spray bottle or whatever. Get it all real nice and wet because you want to rinse off the abrasives as much as you can, the pollen or the dust, whatever's on it. Rinse as much of that off. And then while it's still wet, just use your hand. I know it sounds kind of gross, but getting those bugs off with your hand just works really good. And scratching.
If you used a spray bottle full of water, I'm sure the water would evaporate before it ever hit the hangar floor.
Absolutely.
It's not going to.
If you do it in your hangar,
they're loading up a couple of spray bottles.
A sponge, you know, bucket with a sponge and wipe it off
a
with
bucket,
a sponge.
Yeah.
It's going to just sit in the hangar and evaporate. There won't be any runoff.
Yeah. And then you don't need to use a buffer to polish it. I just spray on wax and just wipe it.
A buffer is going to. I mean, that's going to be pretty hard on the finish.
Well, that's, my husband, I was like, wait, I don't want to take the shine off. Okay.
Yeah. I would go get a few gallon jugs of distilled water at the grocery store. You know, the stuff that you put in steam irons and stuff. And just load your little spray bottles with the distilled water, which is not going to leave any streaks or anything.
And so Victoria, you be the voice of reason. And keep Tim the tool man Taylor away from your airplane.
Art,
who's the tool
Tim?
Man Taylor.
Don't get her in trouble. Jeez.
Now, since we have been in the past, cleaning, the plane with the Simple Green, and we haven't been washing it off, and we wanted to put more of a shine on, what type of wax would you recommend to bring back that shine? Any areas that might be not as shiny? Like, my husband's like, it's clean. I was like, no, but the light doesn't reflect the same on that area as in the other area.
When you wax it, the bugs come off easier next time. So I definitely, I use Meguiar's cleaner wax. Yep. I just spray it on my Lancer and just wipe it down. It looks great.
Why do I get the impression that Victoria is a little OCD?
It's okay. She owns a service.
Perfect. She's perfect.
I'm a dentist. I like details.
We're getting down there. Yeah, but I mean, Paul, what wax do you use?
Well, we typically don't, we don't typically wax people's airplanes. We would be
happy to,
but they don't want to pay us. any automotive wax is fine, but the paint that's on the airplane is not some super duper special airplane only paint. I mean, they are expensive paints. There's no way around it. But pretty much any kind of wax will do just fine.
It's a urethane paint, right? So it's pretty
Most
tough.
Of them are urethane paints. They're tough. Yeah. They're strong paints. So they can handle a lot of stuff, but they don't require a special wax that you can only buy at the airplane store.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And is Cerasys
yes.
have clear coat over the urethane?
No.
Oh, okay. I do.
The Columbia's had clear coat on the cabin, but not on the wings.
I'm clear coated, and that's why it's so heavy. Clear coat has a lot of weight. Yeah,
it has a lot of weight. You know, I may be wrong about that. I got to think about it. My plane is old. I have a 2002. So I don't, there's no clear coat.
Left.
Left.
One area that I noticed on the plane that wasn't, you know, isn't as shiny and I can't get it as clean. Okay. Is the tail. Okay. You know, below the plane. Okay. It's almost like it has like a silver shine to it,
that's
as opposed
exhaust.
To a clear shine. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just an exhaust trail.
And anything to get rid of that?
Simple Green is what I use. And if it's really stubborn, you can use fuel, but that's not going to be great for your
Well, there's some finish. Stuff that specifically for removing exhaust. I forget the name of it.
Oven cleaner?
But there's a
oven
cleaner. I've used geez. Oven cleaner.
That's harsh.
No, there's an aviation product specifically for removing exhaust stains.
But Simple Green is designed for that, and it's gentle on the plane, so that's what I would use.
Just recommend. A little bit more elbow grease and Simple Green. Okay.
Or just don't look at it. don't use that creeper.
Yeah. Don't use too much elbow grease.
Yeah. I'm sure it's beautiful. I'm sure your plane is beautiful, Victoria.
Yeah, you're doing a good job.
Well, I'll definitely be filling up some, you know, water bottles, okay, with my Dawn, okay, and just, you know, regular water and, you know, give that a try.
Don't be afraid to
And don't
to use
be
your
using
hand.
Any of those Shark dental instruments anywhere near that airplane.
and tell Art we said hi. Sorry he couldn't make it.
And we'll watch for you at the next CPPP.
Yeah, we'll be down in Knoxville, I believe.
Oh,
in
good.
2 weeks.
Yeah, I'll see you there. 2 weeks. I'll see you there.
Sounds okay. good. All right.
Thanks for calling. Sorry. See you,
All
Victoria.
Right, take care. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're wrapping up another episode. Hopefully, we got some of your questions right this time. We count on you to let us know and to keep sending us your tricky questions. You can email them to podcasts@aopa.org.
See ya.
Bye-bye.